Welcome to Clan Chat. Welcome back. We've had a little break. We're back refreshed and ready to go. And we're here to talk to one of our former Clan players who's we're absolutely delighted to have back on the show. But let's take you around who's here. There's Jerry McLaughlin, top left-hand corner. Jerry, how have we been? We've not spoke for a while.
No, and I'm trying to make it look like I've lost weight by going for this narrow kind of picture thing. You guys have all gone for the for the landscape. Look, I'm going portrait. Do I look better? Do I look better like this?
I was going to say, so you looked better. A bit different. So, yeah, looking good. Looking good. Bottom right-hand corner, Mr. the voice of the clan himself, Kevin McCoskrey, who looks as though he's in a bar in air. How are you doing?
I wish I was in a bar in air. No, this is just the home bar tonight, but that'll do me for a Saturday night. Times are strange, but yeah, plenty of stock in, so we should be okay.
Excellent.
It's beautifully lit, Kev. It's beautiful.
It is. It's
lit.
Fantastic. Loving it.
We're all coming round after lockdown.
And
I'm moving house.
Oh, so he is. Bottom left-hand corner, our special guest, the man himself with the clan between 2013 and 2015, the D-man who pulls no punches, Mr. Chris Frank. Frankie, good to have you on board. I know you've been desperate to come on. How are you doing?
I'm really good. I'm jacked. I'm jacked up to be here.
Excellent. Well, we're here to talk about you, Chris. Find out, you know, your story about coming to the clan, your career, and find out everything about you. You and I spoke recently for a piece I did for the Herald, and this is how everybody remembers you, as an enforcer, a man that likes a bit of a scrap sometimes. But when you look back on your time in Brayhead, as it was, what's your fondest memories?
There's a lot off the ice. I mean, that's where Jem and I got married. We got married in a little Renfrew. The building,
the government
building, town hall there. Yeah, we got married there. Obviously, Jax was born there, and he got to spend a whole season with us off ice. So, lots of great memories there. And then on ice, I mean, the first season, things that stick out are playoff weekend, because my kid was born that weekend too. Also sticks out is how angry Finner was that I wasn't going to get on the bus for that game in Nottingham. And then how scary my wife and mother-in-law and my mother and my sister-in-laws were when I told them I was thinking about going on the bus to Nottingham.
Oh my God.
And then honestly, just the entire second season I was there, the entire season. It's funny listening to the other guys who come on here talk about it. Just the whole season was so much fun, because there was just so much winning happening. It was awesome.
Now, you first came to the club and, first came to the country rather, 2011, you signed for the Cardiff Devils, a team that were, at the time, a middle table team who had the ability to push on, but just couldn't quite do that. What was it like playing there, your first experience of the UK Hockey League, and what did you make of it when you first came here?
Well, it's funny because I think a lot of North American players hear about the UK is that when I was thinking about coming over was like, you can get, especially college guys, you can get your master's while you're over there. So I was that was the main reason why I wanted to come over. I figured I was kind of getting towards the tail end and I wanted to continue my education. And so the opportunity came up with Cardiff. And then I spoke to some guys that played in Newcastle at the year before, I think actually, cause Sammy was there, wasn't he, Craig?
Yeah, that's
in
right.
Newcastle for a year.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I had some buddies that played on that team and they told me about it, and I was like, okay, how hard do I have to work this summer? Because I've heard things. I'm not sure. My buddy's like, oh, don't worry about it. The first month, you can just use it as training and to get back in shape. And then I get over there, and, I mean, Cardiff came off this monumental season where they lost out by points, similar to us, had some big-time players. And I was supposed to fill the shoes of this former NHL guy that was just an all-around unbelievable player. And I was like, I think you got the wrong guy if you're looking for me to do that. But, you know, I was very surprised and shocked right away. I came in not in the greatest shape, and it took me a while to get into shape, and I definitely could have came in shape. The talent was way better than I expected, and the hockey was really fun. The fan base right away was the most – most different thing that I experienced, because they were so involved and they're so passionate and loud, and they bring that football mentality with the chanting. And then even afterwards, just the amount of involvement where in Cardiff at the BBT, the fans would wait for you until you came out of the locker room, and then you go to the bar and just hang out with them. That seems unheard of in North America. So it was just really fun to kind of get to know everybody in the community. And it was that way even in Sheffield and especially in Glasgow. And it was just really fun.
Now, Jerry, when we think back on the players that we've spoke to all the way through these clan chats, and even the guys that we haven't had on yet that we do discuss quite often, Frankie is one of the guys up there, one of the most memorable, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I think for you, Frankie, I don't know how you feel, but like, I mean, it was my earliest kind of involvement with the team and stuff as well. But the actual just atmosphere around the team, it's something that we've always tried to recreate and have parts of that is that team chemistry, which is such a difficult thing to get and to define. Mm. And I actually do think a really big part of that was you and your family, because at that time we had a relatively kind of young team as well. There wasn't in fact there was no kids around except for Jax. And I remember it was like, it's kind of like the team adopted him. He was like the team's kid. And you're like, cool. what a nice thing that is. And then we go years later and we've had a lot of kids at times and stuff like that. Right. And that can be a different type of fraught. But around that kind of time, you know, Jack just got adopted by everyone. And when you came back for Woody's testimonial, I was in the lift going upstairs because it was quite a busy night, obviously. And this lady gets in the lift and there's this wee boy gets in. As the doors open up, she said, "Come on, Jax." And I was there just thinking, "Jax, there can't be like another one, right?" Surely that must be. And I hadn't seen you yet and stuff. But it just shows you like that was all part of that era. And like, you know, like you said, winning makes it easy. But there was more to that. I mean, he's all had such a great camaraderie and I mean literally fighting for each other. It wasn't just you that was willing to kind of like put your body on the line for the team. There was a number of guys, and I've heard so many people talk to me about that particular type of team because you were all willing to fight for each other. Is that something that you think was unusual, or had you always been in teams that had a bit of that, or was that team, did that seem kind of special?
Every team always has a little bit of that, but I've never been on a team before where everyone was bought in like that. I mean, everybody was bought in. Ice time wise, I think, of course, throughout the course of the season, not everyone's always on the same page about ice time and whatnot. But I mean, for the most part, everyone understood why moves were being made and accepted it and just played within their role. And I think that was a big part of the success. And there weren't any clicks, really. Everyone was hanging out with each other. I mean, like you said, I was the only one with the family, so the boys were pretty free. Even the wives got along really well, and that's a big part of it too, because otherwise if wives don't like each other, then there's just a natural divide. I mean, the guys will be fine 99% of the time, but I mean, when it comes to bonding outside of the rink, that makes it tougher. But yeah, that whole season was just really cool. It was really fun. And I mean, especially in North America, guys are trying to make it up to the next level. So there's cutthroat stuff all the time. There's politics all the time. And it was just nice to be on a team, especially knowing it was my last year, where everyone was just good guys. Everyone just really enjoyed each other's company. And when you have that, you definitely want to play harder for each other.
Do you think that it was, I mean, you knew Finner from obviously before coming to the clan. Do you think that he created, you said there was everyone's bought into the system, everyone's bought into how this team's going to play, what the identity is. Do you think that Finner crafted that style because of the team that he had, or do you think he did try and get the team together to play that type of style? I mean, you knew him from before. Which way around do you think it was?
It's a little bit of both, to be honest with you, because before the season even starts, he knows what kind of team he wants. He knows how many guys he needs to be able to that can just grind. He knows how many guys were there just to score goals. He knows the role players that he needs to have. And outside of that, he's targeting not only those types of players, but now he's targeting personalities. Now he's reaching out to the different, he goes back then, at least, I don't know how it's done in the last few years, but Facebook was a big recruiting tool for a lot of the coaches, and they message players who have played with so-and-so that they knew, what's he like in the locker room. And so you can,
that must
kind
be
of,
hilarious. Is that like someone's just sliding into your DMs? I mean, it is so kind of it's so flirtatious what coaches do. Hey buddy,
can I just say working in the media, when I'm trying to get interviews with players and I'm maybe not on Facebook with them, Frankie's right, it's absolutely brilliant for that. You can just send them a message, tell them who you are, what you're after. 9 times out of 10 they'll come back to you. I absolutely stand with Finner on that one. Bang on. Facebook is a great tool.
If you had many of them, Frankie, if you had that kind of those tweets and you're like, oh my god, I'm not going there, but you get a little high, a little bit of small talk, So, how are you fixed for next year? Not interested. Okay, thanks. No problem.
I don't get that stuff. The first couple of years that I was done, I'd say, well, the first year maybe, I think Finner reached out to me once or twice, and then the guys in Cardiff reached out to me once or twice about guys that were kind of transitioning from the American League and coming over, played in Europe for a while that I played with in North America at some point. But it's funny how fast the transition goes in terms of players that, you know, all of a sudden now all these players are done and it's a whole new group of guys that I've never even heard of before that all seem to be way better than I am when I look at their stats and hear how things are going. So yeah, it's
but you're young as well. I mean, what, you're not 34 now? 33 34 35 34 34.
Keep going.
34. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah. Like you said, for you to be at that stage, you know, out of your career, looking back, still, like, you know, in your early 30s, that's crazy to think that the generation behind you, you're also starting to see those names are progressing on. And I'm guessing with COVID, you must think that there's been a lot more of that. There must be a lot of guys that are like, well, you know, now might be the time. Like, it's as good a time as any to look at something else. Have you seen a lot of that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was, when you look at someone like Scott Arson, I think that probably contributed a little bit. He mentioned it to me. I congratulated him in a message about his retirement. And he's like, yeah, I appreciate it. Got a good opportunity, but also, like, COVID doesn't really help the situation. So,
yeah,
you know, I feel very fortunate that I was able to go out when I wanted to go out on my terms, essentially, for the most part. And for guys with COVID, like, who knows if Scott Pitt would have kept playing, guys like that. It's tough to, when you're in the UK league and you don't have the money to pay players that other leagues in the Europe might be able to play, or even in Russia or something like that, to set out a whole year, especially if you are older hockey player wise, like myself and a couple years younger, and you have families. I mean, to sit out a whole year and just hope that someone's going to pick you up and pay you, it's pretty tough. So yeah, I feel bad for guys for sure.
Let's bring Kevin in. Kevin, yeah, there he's here. On you go.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, Chris, just from a physical point of view, you know, if you've got a guy that's in his early 30s, for example, and let's be real here, we stopped playing sort of end of February, really, 2020. It's probably going to be August 21 before leagues are up and running again. How tough physically would it be for a guy to get back playing again after 18 months out of the game? I mean, I know everybody will be in the same position, but is that why so many of the guys that maybe had another couple of years in them are deciding to go, because they know it's going to be a real tough road back to be able to be match fit come next August?
Yeah, Kevin, that's a really good question. I would definitely think that has something to do with it. Also, I would think that guys who are playing in their 30s still, to be able to play when you're getting older, especially in today's game, it's very fast. I mean, all these guys seem to really take care of their bodies. So I wouldn't even say it's more, in fact, it might be better on the body, because your body has more time to heal from whatever angst you had from the season prior. And physically, I would actually say guys might be in better shape, but I would more worry about the mental aspect of it, because I mean, in an off season, a normal off season, that's just a few months, 5 or 6 months or something like that. I mean, you get into month 4 of the off season and you're going to the gym and you're just like, I'm over this. I just want to get into the games. I want to play hockey. The reason why I'm doing this is to play. So I would more worry that it's the mental aspect that I guess can trickle down to, you know, just being like, all right, I'm taking a few days off here or something like that. Mm.
You know, I was talking to Alex Levitt recently, and he'd mentioned something kind of really similar to what you're saying. Like, when he retired, he was like, so done with that, delighted to move on to the next stage of life and stuff. He said, for a year. And then all of a sudden, like you said, actually, like, because you do think it'd be harder to get back in, but then all the aches and pains suddenly went away. And he's like, going, oh, God, I miss it. But that was around like kind of 14 months. He's like, oh, I miss it. And he said, then you pick up some rec game with your pals and you do like two of those. And you're like, no, I'm over it. No.
It's so true. Totally. When I came over for Christmas a few years back, I think I was done playing for about 2 years at that point, and we went back to Cardiff to hang out with Jem's family for Christmas. I think I messaged Adam Key, because I saw that they're injury riddled. So I'm you know, I'm feeling pretty good. Like 2 years I'm played, I'm not sore or anything. And then, yeah, I messaged him. I was like, hey, man, if you need someone to come in and just fight and then go sit down for the rest of the game, I'll be your guy. And I think Kiefer was just like, okay, Frank, sounds good.
And, did you phone him or did you Facebook him? Was that a Facebook message?
Well, I went and played.
Fest emoji.
In a tournament or something. I played in a beer league and I started skating. And it was like you said with Levitt, like, I got on the ice and I was dying after the first period, which was 20 minutes running time against a bunch of guys who played it, who work at Amazon and Microsoft and just pick the game up kind of thing. I'm like, all right, I'm not messaging Kiefer. I don't want to get killed.
Would you have done it if he'd have said, yeah, if he'd have picked you up, yeah, come on down. Would you have fancied it just for the, are you a thrill seeker, Frankie? Is that a silly question?
I have like, tried to figure out what can replace that rush somewhat. And so like I started like mountain biking. I've almost killed myself mountain biking, gone in the trees on a regular basis. Like my wife made me get this Apple Watch, not because of any other reason than she wants to be able to track me if I'm fell down a mountain somewhere with on my bike. She wants to know where I'm at kind of thing.
And if none of those things taken, none of those things have come close to the same adrenaline.
I wear a backpack. Oh yeah, yeah. It helps. It's helped a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah, those
you
are.
To drive a motorcycle. Now. That's the classic midlife crisis thing. When you've got the motorcycle, in Seattle as well. Do you know what I mean? You're there, man. You can do it. You can get the big Harley there. You should do that.
I have a hard enough time. I have a hard enough time. A, driving a car, and B, I don't know if you know much about Seattle, but we're more of the granola type. We're more of the bicycle on the road versus the motorcycle on the road.
Cool. You can get those ones that are bicycles that are low seats and the big kind of hopper thing. You can do that. That'd be very Seattle.
I'll get a hoverboard.
Nice.
Frankie, while we've got you on, as I mentioned, we spoke the other week there. I did a piece for the Herald, you and I spoke, and I was very interested in what you'd said about your role as an enforcer. We got talking about fighting. And one thing stood out, and I actually used it to lead with the piece, was you got nervous before you got into a fight. I don't know if anybody read the piece, but just remind everybody what you kind of said about that. When you're in that situation, you know, the tension's building up, the crowd are getting behind it. What was it like from your point of view?
Yeah, from my point of view, the nerves start in, like, in the UK where you know who you're playing and you have like a week essentially before you play them. If a certain team had a legitimate tough guy, you always knew there was a chance that it could happen. So, I mean, you start thinking about it, not necessarily a ton throughout the day, but you start thinking about it on Monday, Tuesday, a little bit here and there. And then on the game day itself, I mean, you definitely think about it. But yeah, when you know it's going to happen, like I had a couple instances with Sheffield and Cardiff with Guy Lapine, me and him like to go after each other and he's a tough dude. And there was a couple times where we said at the end of a period, like, okay, we're going at the start of the next period. And I mean, the nerves, the buildup because of just everything involved for me always came on until the fight to the point where I was like, I couldn't stop. Like whenever you saw me square off and I couldn't stop moving. It wasn't because that's my thing. It was just because I can't stop moving, man. I just got to go in there and get it done. And then once the fight started happening, like that's when you just kind of, the nerves go away and you're just in the moment and then the fight's over. And once you sit in the penalty box, that's when I was like at my calmest. That's when I was like, okay, let's go play a hockey game. Now I got that out of the way kind of situation. But yeah, it's funny how that stuff kind of works.
If we knew that, we could have organized a street fight for you outside just to calm your nerves before the game. We could have found some drunkards in the street for you, like, I'm sure. Or you must have been delighted the next season when Lee Salters was in the lineup and you've got Fitzgerald's there and you've got even Derek Rail was picking up fights. And I mean, you have like, I literally spoke to Matt Nickerson at a playoff finals weekend once. In the toilet of the hotel we're staying in, and he came up and he was perfect like spot. Jerry, and I was like, "Oh my God, still holding my lad." I was like, "Yeah, you doing, big man?" balls, everything just shrinks back up inside me, and he was just talking away. Just was very, you know, loved the clan and stuff, and talked to me about that season. And he went, "Oh my God, it was terrible that year." He says, "You've got Frankie there barking at me. You've got Fitzy in the warm-ups." He says, "All four of you is just lining up at the blue line." Just shouting at him, and he's like looking around. And he says, "It's just me there." Do you remember those games in particular, and having that kind of backup. He must have felt invincible.
Yeah, I mean, the first season, I think I was the main person that, granted, I still wasn't fighting a ton anyways, but still just the thought that it could happen any night. And if it does happen, yeah. like I'm the one that has to step up in the first season. I mean, we did have Sami Zajac too, who he's a gamer and tough as nails in his own right. But yeah, with someone, when you have legit heavyweights, and I told Craig this the other day too, like I don't even consider myself a good fighter or a legit heavyweight. I was just someone who was willing because of the way I played and just because I'm a so when you're an asshole enough times, you're going to have to fight. but to have like Fitzy, who knocked out the first three people he fought, I think, and then Salts that everyone knew about him going into the season prior with Nottingham and then playing against him too and him just being Jason Momoa on skates was terrifying. So
it's a very good description.
I knew that I was a number three essentially when it came in the heavyweight line. So for me, I just skate around with a bunch of swag. And I think a lot of guys skate around with a bunch of swag because they had nothing to worry about. And then Derek Rail stole my celebration in one of the fights with that Dundee dude.
He
used to tell me all the time, he's like, Frank, he used to love getting me riled up for whatever reason. I was a senior in college. He was a freshman. So I was on him hard all the time because I hated his guts just because he's so arrogant. And then I grew to love him, as a lot of people do. If you learn not to take him seriously, you just love the guy. So he'd get on my nerves and fife all the time and give me the face washes because he knew I wouldn't do anything to him. But yeah, he said he's going to steal my celly. And then after he fought Hutchinson, I think, for Dundee, he got up there and did the old shotgun Frank Tank. And he looked right at me with the biggest shitting grin. And I was like, all right, man.
Surely it's just that's something you don't do. Surely. And then I'm also forgetting, you also had Jeff Smith signed in the middle of that season. Another huge guy. And I think it was at the Christmas Do, the Clan Christmas Do that year. I remember, like, Jeff, who is, you know, by all accounts and from my experiences of him, legitimately the nicest human being on the planet.
Gentle giant. Ice.
Yeah, just literally a gentle giant. I'd heard that he did the, you know, he washed the kits in Hull. And then Finner's like, no, that's not true. We asked him, oh, yeah, no one else was going to do it. So I did it. And there was a time at the Oran Mór where you're talking, because you guys had gone at it a couple of times in the past. And I think you were at the bar and you heard him talking about you and you want to go. And he's like, no, dude, I don't. That's the point. We're on the same team now. Do you remember that? He was such a nice guy. No.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
You're like, you want to go? He's like, no.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, he's a monster in itself too. So, yeah, the amount of toughness we had on that team was insane. But then there's guys that, and I think they're the ones who are legit heavyweights who they love it. I don't know if Fitzy ever got nervous. That guy just loved it. And
yeah,
he's just an animal. By the way, Kevin Bergen, he was another guy who fought that first season. I can't forget about him. He was a killer too.
I wanted to ask you about your relationship with Nickerson, because it was all built up on the ice because of the confrontations you had. Did you ever get a chance to see him after you finished playing? I know he's recently finished playing himself. Have you ever spoken to him, or, you know, is there a mutual respect there between you? What's the deal?
No, I never had a chance to speak with him away from the rink. And even being done playing, I haven't really spoke to anyone. I mean, I have a hard enough time keeping up with guys that I was friends with and played with. but it's funny Jerry's story though, because when I talked to Rail, because he was on that first season in Fife, like he would relay to me that Nickerson genuinely hated me off the ice too. And so to me, I look at hockey as I had a role, but I also love the entertainment side to it. So to be able to do anything to try to get under his skin too, it was just fun for me. But I mean, obviously, the guy was a fan favorite for a reason, not just fighting, I imagine. So you watched his games. I mean, he was on the ice 20 plus minutes a game and all situations. So you have to respect him. And he steps up to anytime you got someone who steps up for your teammates, you know, that's a guy you'd want on your team if you had the chance, for sure.
Right, hypothetical. He watches this. He reaches out to you. He says, Frankie, I'm coming to Seattle. Fancy going for a beer. What do you say?
I say, let's get our mountain bikes, go try to kill ourselves, and then we'll go for a beer.
You have changed.
Absolutely. Kevin, of course, being in that area where you are every night, you hear everything. The crowd are pumped. What was it like when Frankie came on the ice, and you know the reaction he got from the fans?
I think Chris was just one of those guys that, when he was on the ice, people expected something to happen. You know, I would kind of describe Chris Frank as great box office. You know, he's the type of player that sells tickets for hockey games because people will come along and expect that maybe something's going to happen when Chris is on the ice, which is absolutely fantastic and what every club needs. But, you know, Chris brought a huge amount to the Clan because if you think back to that season, the amount, and it's been mentioned already, the word community and, you know, the engagement, and you tend to forget the stuff that happens off the ice as well. And, you know, all the good charity stuff Chris was involved in that it really brought a lot of people together and made the club much more of a better fit for the community around it, I think. So the value that he brought to the Clan in those 2 years was fantastic. And I just think Chris's career, unfortunately, ended too soon. 29's far too young to be giving up the game. And we would have loved to have seen him play a bit longer. Was there a reason for that, Chris? Why was it 29?
I mean, first, I appreciate the kind words, Kevin. It was just with Jax and everything, and for me, I mean, I didn't have a big contract in North America to start my nest with. So, you know, to go back every summer and try to find an apartment somewhere and then, you know, stay with the parents for a while, that's all fine when you're single or you're with – or when I was with Jem even, and we didn't have a kid. But once you have a kid in the mix, you know, you want to start, for me, I wanted to start establishing something, a home that we could actually call home. So for me, that meant joining the workforce at some point, unfortunately. And I'm glad I did at 29, because my introductory to the workforce was cold calling in one of those tech centers. And I was 29, and everyone coming out of there was 21. And it doesn't seem like a big gap, but when you have a kid and they're just coming out of the college party time, I'm glad I'm not working in the call center starting my life at 34. Let's just say that. Yeah.
Yeah, but that was quite good though when they asked, so what have you been doing before this? And you could just say fighting professionally. I'm pretty sure that might reduce a 21-year-old cold caller who's being a bit chirpy about his youthfulness.
it's funny. It's funny because for the first year, when people ask me, like when I came back home and meet people in the community or whatever, people ask, oh, what do you do? I just had such a hard time saying I'm in sales for the first year. So I'd always be like, I'm in sales, but I just finished playing professional hockey. So I just couldn't let go. I couldn't let go of it. But I mean, now it's 6 or 7 years later, and you know, now I am who I am. But yeah, it was really tough for me to let go of that title that I've been doing my whole life.
Well, we'll take a break there. We've got lots more to catch up with Frankie on. So we'll wrap it there just now. Join us for part two. We'll talk a bit more about Frankie's career. And I dare say one or two stories might crop in there as well. Join us for part two very shortly. Welcome back to Clan Chat, part two. And as you can see, everybody's moved. It's like musical chairs. Kevin's on the top left-hand corner. Welcome back, Kevin. Jerry's in the bottom left-hand corner. And our special guest this week is Chris Frank, the bottom right-hand corner, currently joining us from Seattle. Now, as we record this, it's Saturday night. It's on the day the American presidential race was finally decided. Frankie, what's it been like in your part of the world? And give us an insight into what it's been like the last few days.
Just a lot of anxiety, I think, around the country. A lot of just nonstop refreshing their Google pages or Safari pages to see if anything's changed in the last 5 seconds from you last looked. It's pretty wild to see that it was announced. So it's massive news over here. And where I particularly live, we live in a pretty liberal blue area. So where I'm at, you know, for the most part, people are pretty ecstatic, for sure.
Excellent. I mean, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording, just where we are, it's been constant over here as well. You know, Kevin, Jerry, have you been watching it? Have you been keeping an eye on what's been happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to take an interest in it. It's probably the best soap on television at the moment, isn't it? I mean, yeah. It's really entertaining. But, you know, as the numbers were coming through and it started to become obvious that Biden was going to take the White House, and in a way, much as I think that's the right thing for America and for the world, in my humble opinion, I'm going to miss the guy. It's been a real, it's been like watching the Truman Show or something the past few years. It's been real unbelievable entertainment, and, you know, just going from one thing you think you can't do anything more stupid than that to the next month he's said something or done something else. But it has been a very interesting tenure, I guess, because I don't think any of us ever thought we would see a character like that as the most powerful man in the world.
Mm-hmm. And so, you're right, I think that was actually one of the biggest things that's going to happen, though, with Trump, isn't it? It's because he is so entertaining. He got a lot of screen time before becoming the president anyway. And it's something, it's a difficult thing to talk about, isn't it? Because the world's very polarized at the moment anyway. And you're looking, I know the social dilemma's doing the rounds and stuff at the moment. And, but, you know, like my brother, we're very, very different now in our political opinions. And he's living in Pennsylvania at the moment. And so you've always got to be very sensitive, haven't you, to, like, you know, what's happened. And, you know, as much as it's a massive victory for Biden, it's unbelievable that the second highest number of votes of all time has been Trump, and he's lost this election. So it's, you know, it's, there's going to be a lot of healing that has to take place, and you just, it will take a bit of time. So it's an interesting world we live in, man. You've picked a good time to leave hockey. You'll probably get a job bouncing on the streets of America if you want for a while. It's going to be everyone was expecting a lot of civil unrest, weren't they? And it's not, thank God, it's not happened so far. Do you feel like that where you are, that it doesn't feel like that, does it? Not in Seattle.
I mean, there's been civil unrest since when coronavirus first started with George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protest. And I mean, it's been going on for a long time in terms of on the streets and what you're seeing. It's also, you know, even in our little community, we went in support of a Black Lives Matter peaceful protest as well in our little community that has 10,000 people. We live about a half hour east of Seattle. And so you see it all around. And yeah, it's very polarizing. I also think, you know, as polarizing as it is, I was talking about it with my wife last night. People that voted for Trump, it's a lot of people say that they generalize, right? They're racist or something like that. You know, I think the majority of people that voted that way vote that way, not necessarily for the individual, but based off a party's morals, whatever those are. And a lot of people vote on one particular reason. And obviously there's a lot of different things that go into one individual, but a lot of them just say, hey, I think this is the best thing for my economy. This is the way that this party typically goes, and this will help me get food on my table. So as much as you see chaos in our communities, according to the news, even in Seattle, you see protests in Portland, Oregon, you see protests all the time. I mean, these are in very small pockets of our community that we never see. It's not like that. Most of us are, whether you're on one side or the other, most of us all want the same thing. We just want to live in our own homes, have a job, take care of our families, and get along with our neighbors. You know what I mean?
I think that feels very missing at the moment, that sentiment where, like, one thing people should be able to agree on is that we all want the best for our communities. And I think if people can start from that starting point, you're right, then you might totally disagree on how to achieve that aim, but at least you can agree that we've all got the same aim. That's a really good starting point. I think that's a great point. I hope more people are thinking like that.
Yeah, me too.
I think there's a lot of Joe Biden fans in my corner of Ayrshire because there's fireworks going off here. I think Biden's so popular down here. So, yeah
well, Joe Biden / Guy Fawkes fans are having a fantastic time at the moment. That's the kind of thing at the moment. It's been a weird bonfire night, hasn't it? Here, it's been bizarre because it's just not been kind of
mentioned. Is that bonfire night right now?
Yeah, well, last night. Well, sorry, two nights ago. So okay, it's quite odd. There's still a lot of fireworks.
Can I transition something about Guy Fawkes or Guy Fox?
Guy Fox.
Fox. Okay.
Maybe so, language. Fork, what's the language? You get the edit button out.
Guy Fawkes, does he?
So Guy Fawkes night, fireworks night, second year, I got Jax with me, Gem's working. We go downtown Glasgow to check out the fireworks show. So, you know, where they have all the fences around and the big fairs and everything. We went down there, cruised around and had a good time. And then see the fireworks, and then me and him take off, get back in the clan car, right? Yeah. Was it a clan car? I don't remember what car I had, whether it was littered with clan stuff or not. But I get back in the car with them, and we're driving, and whichever little downtown area we're in, obviously there's tons of traffic, and we're light. So I see people walking on the sidewalks, leaving and everything, and there's a lot of old couples walking around. And all of a sudden, some fireworks just start blasting at people on a sidewalk. And I was like, whoa, what is happening? And I see old people like ducking and everything. And so I get out of the car because I see two like teenagers around the corner and I, like by an alleyway. And I was like, you know, just thinking I'm going to be a hero or whatever. I was like, hey, what are you doing? And all of a sudden I hear like 30, I kid you not, like 30 voices go, hey, hey, hey. And I see like a whole crowd of teenagers come around like, come on, come on. I was like, oh. This isn't good. And there's a stop at a red light. And I got my 5-month-old, 6-month-old in the back of the car. It's like, oh, okay, I'm going to close the door now. So I close the door, but I can't find the lock because I think I've switched cars like 3 times in the last month because we're the only ones with a family. And so like all of a sudden the kids start coming and they start booting the car. And I think, and then one of them opened the back door for a second. I was like, no, light turns green. I think the kid who opened the back door, I think he saw there was a baby and he didn't actually think the doors would be open. So when he saw the baby, I think he closed it right away because he's like, oh my God, this is, we were just trying to scare him. But yeah, yeah, I booked it. And all of a sudden as I'm booking it, a big trash can goes flying on my windshield. And it was chaos, man. It was at that moment where I was like, all right, my days of being a hero are done now that I'm a dad, I guess.
You sure they weren't filming World War Z or something in Glasgow?
Oh, no, maybe.
That would have been about that time, yeah. That would have been about that time.
Maybe. That was insane, though.
Do you remember, Frankie, what you told me? I remember, like, talking to you once, and it was maybe one of those times where you were suspended. And I was talking to you.
When was that?
How are you getting on? I was just asking you how you're getting on, how you enjoying Glasgow, and you were like, you told me a story about walking along the canal, walking along the Clyde River with your dog. And like, I love this story. I tell this story regularly to people when you imagine these guys coming over from North America, how are they settling into Glasgow? I think a lot of people do wonder, like, how are you fitting in day-to-day life? And you were just saying, yeah, you've been loving it, except the weather was starting to get you down. Do you remember when you took your dog for a walk and there was just like a gap in the clouds with a shard of light? And you said you just stood in it with the dog and you both just took it in and it went away and you looked at each other and went, that was nice.
That was nice. We're settling in well.
Not missing the weather then too much.
I mean, Seattle's the same thing as the UK.
Yeah.
We're rain like 9 months a year. And then I will say that Glasgow, my last year, we stayed right up until July 1st. And I couldn't believe it that it would be daylight until almost 11 o'clock at night, but it would be pouring down rain and humid the entire time. I was like, oh my God, such a tease. But I mean, for the most part where I'm from, it's very similar to the UK. I'd say more so like Wales in Cardiff than anywhere. That like Sheffield even had some snow for a while. We don't even really get that much snow, to be honest, but it was just so easy to settle in. And granted, I was there for a few years already, but it's just so fun. The UK is so fun. It's just such a cool thing with the history and the architecture and just the overall view on life with pubs on every corner and the pub culture where I always tell friends, like, yeah, I couldn't believe it because you go to the airport and anytime we flew to Belfast on other teams, the breakfast menu always was like English or Irish breakfast with a pint. Everything was with a pint. I was like, oh,
international people,
they're way more, yeah, they're way more open about their alcoholism than we are. We hide it. We just sneak our drinks in.
Joe, I mean, another interesting place you played, though, I've always wanted to ask you about this, is like Las Vegas. And when you look at the success of the Golden Knights now and what an amazing thing that's been, but you were playing there for the Wranglers when they were there. What was that like playing in Vegas at that time? Obviously, in an entirely different, you know, situation with the Wranglers. But what that must have been pretty crazy as well, surely.
It was amazing. It was insane. I came home with $0. No, but it was really fun. And don't feel too bad. Coming home with $0 on an East Coast contract isn't that hard to do. But Vegas was – it was my first year out of college, too, and it was just awesome. You're down at the Strip, like, for the first month almost every day. As soon as practice is over, everyone's going down the Strip. And then, funny enough, after the first month, you get tired of it real fast, like any other big city kind of thing. It's like, oh, it's just chaos down there. It's expensive. There's a lot of people. It's traffic, all that stuff. But I mean, on the weekends, you never have an excuse of being bored. Like, you can't say you're bored in Vegas. You can go to a show. You can go anywhere. You can do anything you want in that city. Hockey wise, it was such a luxury because I was playing in what guys who have played for a while called the retirement side of the league, because you have on the West Coast, you never go east because it's too expensive. So you just play the same 7 or 8 teams all season. And they're all in sunny areas. Like, your travel's not bad. You're in sunny areas. You're in California half the time. Vegas itself actually had an unbelievable – and I knew the team would do well there because just for the East Coast team, there was lots of support. I mean, Thursday, they had – every Thursday home game, it was dollar beer, dollar dog night, and we'd get 7,000-plus people. It was insane.
Wow. And were they tourists or were they locals? Were they, because that's a lot of the thing that people say about the Golden Knights. It's the hottest ticket in town, but, you know, it is the casinos, it is the hotels that have bought up a lot of the tickets. They've got the season tickets. Was it like that for the Wranglers? Yeah.
I don't know if that's true.
That's just what I've heard. I don't mean to do a Trump. I've done a bit of a Trump there. A lot of people saying that. That's what's being said. That's what I've heard. But was that the case?
Yes, for his man, Jerry. He's just for his man now. Come on.
I know. I need to work on a Biden impression.
It makes sense that they would do it that way. I think of most of ours where I think we're locals. We were playing in the – I don't know if anybody knows Vegas that well, but we were playing in an arena called the Orleans, which was just off the Strip, but it was 5 minutes off the Strip. And to be honest with you, I don't think most people, when they come to Vegas for the 2-3 days that they're going, are interested in going to a minor league hockey game. You never know. But I would say most of them are probably locals. The NHL team could be very different for sure. It was funny, though, because I also said to buddies as soon as they got a team, I was like, I don't know how good they're going to be, but I promise you they will have one of the best home records in the entire league. Because we did, and that team, even before me and after me, always had a great home record, because as soon as teams come in, I mean, they may be coming in from a small town in the middle of nowhere on the East Coast where they don't see any fun, like I played in 1 year, and they come to Vegas for a night. You think they're just going to go to their hotel room? It's like, there's no chance. So there's guys that you play a game and they just got, like, they didn't go to bed. And I talked to buddies and I talked to guys on the other side during warmups, and they'd be completely red, like lobster red, because they're just hanging out by the pool all day long at XS or whatever it's called. And then you're just like, all right, it's going to be a fun night.
I did not think you were going there with that. I thought you were going to say, but the home crowd are just so pumped. It's like a fortress. Oh, yeah. I didn't think about you. There's the sirens out there luring the guys onto the rocks. There's just so many sirens.
Oh, yeah.
That's crazy.
It's you drop your bag off in your room, you're like, all right, where are we going, boys? That's what it's like on the away side. And it was funny because I was on that side the following year. I played in a town called Elmira, and it was upstate
Kev
New York.
Kev just got off to book a trip to Las Vegas. As soon as COVID's
I'm out of
over.
Here.
Okay, where were we?
I totally forgot what I was going to say, but yeah, it was super fun.
And you contrast that to coming to a place like Glasgow. And we as Scots can be quite negative about where we're from. I think it's just in our DNA. And you look at the contrast between living in Las Vegas for a year and then coming to Glasgow. What was that like? You know, you get the bright lights of Vegas, just everything you've just described there. And then Glasgow, by comparison, is quite drab. Would you, you know,
no,
you see where I'm coming
Las Vegas,
from?
Come on, Craig.
Oh, I love Vegas. Glasgow. Is I love Glasgow. But you go from Vegas to Glasgow, it's quite a culture change, is what I'm getting at.
What sand.
I think the Vegas part, funny enough, like by the end of the season, there's always like a little banger, a little bender at the end of the season just to say goodbye to the boys, because you know more than likely it's the last time you're going to play on their team again. You're going to be and you might communicate here and there via WhatsApp or whatever the case is, but you know, a few years down the road, you probably won't be talking. So every year there's always a little fun for a few days after. But when it came to Vegas, man, a lot of us couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. Like, it was just exhausting. Yeah. It was so tiring to live there. I mean, 3 days there, full tilt, is insane. But also, to your point of like transitioning from like a Vegas to an Elmira where I played, and then to Cardiff and Sheffield and Glasgow, a lot of, I my junior town was a small town in Vancouver Island called Duncan. It's like 30,000 people surrounding area. It's the smallest town ever, but it really is the community that you play in, and you're there. At the end of the day, you're there for hockey. And one of the funnest teams outside of my last year in Glasgow I played on was the town in Elmira. There was nothing to do. The claim to fame at the time was there's two maximum security prisons within 5 miles of each other. Tupac was at one of them. That was the claim of fame, supposedly 50 Cent. I don't know. But that was one of the, all you did was just rent movies or go bowling. And the whole team would go bowling together on Monday. And that was one of the closest, funnest years I had in a town that and that's coming from Vegas, you know? So Glasgow was amazing just because the fan base really helps you get used to the area. You got tons of support, whether you want extra work, whether you want ideas on what to do, whatever the case is, the supporters club was amazing. Like Leslie Ballmer and Tracy Ross were awesome at anything. And Kevin mentioned some of the fundraising stuff. And anytime I brought up an idea to anyone, like Tracy or Leslie, like they were 100% behind me with the teddy bears and all that stuff that we did. It was really fun.
I think that's the biggest sort of testament to you, Frankie, as well. It's like we're super proud at the club now of the culture of the club, and obviously year on year that grows and gets stronger. But certainly the years that you were here and you yourself laid a lot of the groundwork for that. Like that was a movement, and it came from the dressing room. It came from guys like yourself and Gemma as well. Like, and that stuff that we've, once you have it, it's our job to keep a hold of that and help it grow. But you've been a massive part of that for the club, and it's you know, it's a real, hopefully it's something you look back and are proud of in your career, because it's something that's still there. And I hope you saw that when you came back for Woody's testimonial. I hope you saw those seeds growing and you know, you can trace it back to things that you guys have done. I hope there was a sense of pride in that.
Yeah, Jem and I would, I mean, we both appreciate you saying things like that. The management side, like what Craig does on the media side, and people like you and Kevin behind the scenes, that, I mean, Jerry, you're a little more up front and center kind of thing. I've seen your videos of front of a fireplace at dark. But Kevin with the behind the scenes stuff, I listened to Kevin's interview podcast, and that, I thought that was amazing, Kevin, the podcast that you did about the life of an announcer and how you got into it. That's a side of the sport and a story I've never heard before. And I just thought it was so interesting to hear your thoughts on it and just how you got into it. And then also just your progression through the different ranks and different teams. It was really cool. And it's, I mean, it makes sense that Glasgow is really succeeding right now with people like yourself kind of showing how things are done. So yeah, I'd say it's definitely more on you guys than it is any of the players. I mean, they just got to win, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that would help. It's great that you're still involved.
Let me just point out that podcast Frankie's referring to is Craig Simpson's Voices of Hockey, which you can still hear. Download it on your device. It's an absolutely fantastic episode to listen to. So check it out if you haven't yet already. Frankie, you touched upon the reasons why you retired back in 2015 a little bit earlier. Do you regret anything about the retirement? And I'm thinking more, in fact, of the Champions Hockey League campaign, which came the following year. I'm sure you would have loved to have been part of that. Would that be right in saying that maybe there's a slight regret on that one?
No, but I do remember that, like,
kills that, then.
I knew you were going to say that. I knew he was going to say that, because I remember talking to you in the Wetherspoons at the end of that season, and I was like, surely you're coming back, man. That usual kind of fan thing that you'd say to guys when you want them to come back, and you were like, that's, you know, like, I've enjoyed this season. It was about that season for you, and you know, the Champions, that kind of adventure wasn't as big as the adventure you were maybe going to have in your actual life with your family. It's so funny to see you ask that question, Craig. I was just wondering how bluntly you were going to answer it. And that's what you said, same thing. So yeah,
well, you haven't changed your mind. I was going to bring that up about, I remember that Weatherspoon's conversation too, because you're like, the champion is leaving. And it is amazing what the U, not just Glasgow, and they got the win, but what the UK has been able to do in the Champions League, and it, the talent that you guys are having in that league these days is, I mean, it's tenfold even than when I was playing with skill level. So naturally the game's progressing that way too. And it's just great to see you guys competing on that kind of scale. But yeah, for me personally, I mentally prepared myself that was going to be my last year no matter what. And the fact I got as much gratification out of knowing that I was part of something that gave that team that opportunity as much as I would have gotten gratification actually playing. So, and then I'm a sore loser. I start losing my mind. So I probably wouldn't even made it through the first game of Champions League after 9-0 or whatever it was.
10-2, but we don't talk about
10-2, it. 10-2, yeah. Did you have a little bit of a feeling where you're like, gosh, you know, maybe we'd like to, what was the score? Ooh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Whoa.
Yeah, we were there, Jerry. We remember it well.
It was a really impossible task for the team, like, to come into it with literally less than zero prep, completely underprepared to score some goals like that and give us moments of joy was amazing, and then to progress and... But you must have been watching that just going like, ooh.
Well, to be honest, too, I mean, like, you're playing against teams that have not just former NHL guys, but guys who are potentially going to be playing in the NHL. So, I mean, a lot of – and it's this may have changed in the last 6 years or so, but a lot of us that come over are coming over because we just want to finish our career somewhere, and just be in an English-speaking country where our families can communicate well with the community. And just kind of really enjoy yourself and play really competitive hockey. And that's a big contrast. In fact, that's part of the reason why when I went to, after Cardiff, I went to San Francisco in the East Coast League during a lockout. And I had that mentality in Cardiff that I had when I went over there, where I was like, I'm just playing to have fun at this point. I'm not trying to make it anywhere and progress up the ladder. And playing, I just felt bad that I felt like I was taking a spot of somebody, because you could see in their eyes that drive to want to get to the next level. And that's part of the reason I wanted to come back after talking with Finner to Sheffield. The fact that you guys got the Champions League that first year was amazing. But now it's gotten to the point where your UK teams are competing, not just showing.
You did have those moments as well, though, Frankie. Sorry, Kev. There you go.
No, I was just going to say, Jerry, I think it was quite telling, if you remember, that the Player of the Year awards when Frankie finished up. Finner was absolutely in bits at the sort of announcement that Chris was retiring. And yet Chris was able to talk about it with absolute surety and seemed quite cool about the whole thing. And that just smacked to me of a guy that was comfortable in his decision and knew that his time was right. And I would also say, Chris, I really admire you for doing that, because, you know, there's nothing sadder than seeing an old pro having to be told when it's time to hang them up. And you were able to go on your own terms and choose your moment and leave, when you were still pretty much at the top of your game. So fair play to you in that, and I really admire you for making that decision.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I did feel bad that I didn't expect Finner to say if I want to say any words, and he did choke up a bit, I think, and I think I chirped him.
He's an emotional guy. He's an emotional guy, man. Definitely.
He's awesome.
But you did have those moments though in your career then where you're called up to the A. So when you're getting caught, so when you're like playing in the East Coast League and your coach calls you in and you're like, right, what's this gonna be about? And they're like, yeah, you're going. Were you like, oh man? You're like, sick. I've got to pack my bag. Like, what, myself? Like, what were your thoughts in those times when you were getting called up, and what were the reasons for it? Do you remember like the circumstances of it?
Yes, super excited. Super excited, number one. Number two, though, yes, to your point, like I'm a homebody. I like knowing where I'm going to be. I like my routines. I think a lot of hockey guys are. And when you get called up, like, you're probably in a hotel. I was in a hotel for like a month the last time I got called up. I think it was a month or something like that. And I mean, by the time I finally got let go and sent back down, it was almost like, this sucks, but like, thank God, like, I get to go see my boys again. And it's and maybe that's why I didn't make it, because I didn't just I wasn't just focused on like, this is part of the process, suck it up, let's do it. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely a little bit of like, oh, you're sending me down? Okay, I need to work on my foot speed like everyone tells me. Noted. I'll see you when I see you.
But that's the hardest way to do it, surely, as well. Like, it's different when you're going through, if you're going into the American Hockey League and you've got a preseason with a team and you can bed in with them and that's your boys, that's your home boy. To be parachuted in is difficult in anyone's experience of a job or a work or school or whatever it is, let alone in pro sports when you're also joining a bunch of players that, you know, I don't know, they might not necessarily, they want their team to do well, but they're competing with you as well. So that's the hardest way to do it. It must be very difficult.
My first game, my first pro games and team were with Adam Keefe, actually, on San Antonio Rampage, and we played a similar role. They even had me play forward at one point. And I think I was taking some of his games, too, because San Antonio wasn't doing well. So I came out of college, so they're always going to give a college kid a shot, right?
Yeah.
So it has nothing to do with Kiefer's play, because he's the ultimate when it comes to knowing his role and playing his role. But I just remember him being like a little frosty at first, but then being like, Frank, keep working, man, keep doing it, you're doing a good job, kind of thing. And we even ended up on a line, and I remember it was me, him, and I think Frankie Lassard, who's an animal in the fighting community. And I remember Keith looked at me, he's like, anything goes, Frank. I don't care what you do. Just do anything you want, and I'll jump in there. I was like, well, this is terrifying, but okay, let's do it.
Wow. How did that like do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I got in – we got in tons of fights. I mean, I think I had 6 fights in 12 games and got knocked out once, and it was awesome. I loved every second of it.
Jeez, old man. Gosh, yeah. That's crazy. Beautiful.
So let's take you back to earlier this year. You were back for Matt Haywood's testimonial. What was it like to get the call, and what was it like to be back in the arena with everybody else there, seeing the new guys, the old guys and everything else? Tell us, you know, what it was like from your point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I know Matty just had a baby, and I'm a little bummed he couldn't make it on here, because I wanted to say that
he'll be
first
watching.
Off, thank him. Yeah, thank him for having us come over and be part of it. Even though he told me he would do that when I was there, so I expected it. But 2 kids, 1 baby, 6-year-old, that's crazy. Get on a plane for hours, drive from London to Cardiff, drive up to Scotland, get up there, and then I don't even get the text message for the Brazilian Steakhouse night. And I'm trying to figure out why I don't get the text message for Brazilian Steakhouse night. I only traveled 30, 40, 50 hours to come hang out with my good buddy, Matty Haywood, and I don't get the text. I'm not sour. I'm not sore, but it's cool. It's cool. It's cool.
And then
he put me in the hardest shot, which I never do good in the hardest shot. I miss the net on a regular basis. I think I almost took your head off, Jerry.
Yeah, damn right. I never should have stood
there. I got
there.
Beat by the backup goaltender in goalie skates and hockey player gear. The guy was out to get me, I think. He brought me over for a laugh.
Listen, Frankie, you've got to be careful. If you keep whinging like this, Woody's not going to invite you to his second testimonial.
I can't wait for that 20 year. But it was Woody's testimonial was amazing. It was so fun. I was lucky enough to be part of a few. I think I had 3 or 4 at that point. And none of them were done as well as Woody's in terms of the game night itself and the packages that were available and the brochures. The fan base showing up was insane. And just the entertainment of it all was just awesome. And it was exactly what you would want. And seeing guys that, obviously I played with, it was so fun to catch up with those guys and just see how everyone's doing. And obviously everyone's doing great. Yeah, it was a good time. I'm so glad we got it in there before everything kicked off.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a good time to end it there. A wonderful clan chat. I've thoroughly enjoyed this one tonight. Jerry, good to see you again. Thanks for coming on board as always.
Yeah, no, thanks for having us, and great chat with me, Frankie, as always. We'll Excellent. See you over here soon. As soon as COVID's done. Get that banner up. It's happening. It's happening.
Kevin, that's welcome awesome. Back. Good to see you again. Hope you enjoy that nice little bar of yours in the background.
Pleasure. Yeah, I intend to. And great to chat with you, Chris.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was good seeing all you boys. I appreciate it.
Yep, and you too, Frankie. Good to hear your stories and good to hear so many great things about your time here in Glasgow. Before we do finish up for real, we've got the Shut Off the Back competition for this week's Clan Classics game. Keep an eye out for that. Information will be on the website and on social media as well, so keep an eye out for that. But thank you for watching this edition of Clan Chat, and we'll have another one for you next week. Gentlemen, thank you very much again, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Yes.
Yep.